Yeah, well, you ought to be more careful. She starts away, then stops and turns back. Maybe you should be, too. A flush rises in his cheeks. Gotcha, Gwendy thinks. A few minutes later, while scraping their plates into the vacuum receptacle at the other side of the cafeteria, Kathy asks, "What in the hell was that all about?" "What do you mean?" "Come on, you were poking at him." "I was just curious." "About what?" "How he'd respond to a poke. Did you see that flush?" Kathy frowns. "I didn't notice." Gwendy watches her walk away, thinking, test or no test, she still doesn't trust me completely. Well, I've got news for you, lady. The feeling is mutual. On the way back to her quarters, Gwendy makes a brief diversion to the weather deck to check on the latest readings. She knows that some staff members back in the down below, maybe even most of them, don't expect her to perform much more than a lick and a promise when it comes to her climate monitor duties. But that just makes her want to exceed expectations and prove them all wrong. It's how she's always been wired. Her laptop is back in her room, so she scribbles a couple of notations in a moleskin ledger and returns it to its place in the top drawer of the desk. When she's finished, she writes a reminder note about tomorrow's video conference with faculty members from the University of Maine and sticks it right in the middle of one of the monitor screens. No way can she forget that, she hopes. When she gets to her room a short time later, she makes a beeline for the sofa. She's suddenly exhausted, and all she wants to do is lie down and rest her brain. It's strange, she thinks. She watched a video earlier this afternoon of her husband being murdered, not to mention the four odd creatures in yellow coats and their mile-long ugly green car, if it even was a car, she thinks. But after shoveling a bit of shit in Winston's direction at dinner, she feels a little more in control of things. In fact, she feels surprisingly steadfast. For the first time in days, she's not even thinking about the button box and its magic bag of tricks and treats. Eyes growing heavy, she props a pillow under her head and gets comfortable. Just before she dozes off, she notices her laptop sitting open on the coffee table and thinks, wait a minute, didn't I close that before I left and put it away? Probably she didn't. She's gotten so forgetful. Then her eyes slide the rest of the way shut, and she's sleeping the dreamless sleep of the innocent. Chapter 36. Day 4 on Many Flags. Gwendy brushes her teeth, rinses the night cream off of her face, and ties her hair back in a ponytail. Then she dresses in blue shorts and an eagle-heavy tee. She figures a vigorous walk around the outer rim might help to keep her head clear and increase her appetite for breakfast. She never seems to be hungry anymore, and that worries her. Take last night, for example. She enjoyed her time at the dinner table, especially poking Gareth Winston, that was the high point, but she barely touched the food in her tray. She will this morning. Appetite or no appetite. Only 3 more days until her spacewalk with the pocket rocket, and she can use all the calories she can get. Gwendy doesn't even consider going for a run. That little act of misguided lunacy, chocolates or no chocolates, could have easily backfired and ended in disaster. She can picture the scene without even trying. The senator from Maine floating on her back, unresponsive, as her misfiring 64-year-old heart sputters. Dale Glenn, surrounded by the other crew members, dutifully administering epinephrine and doing CPR. Alas, the sputtering heart quits. After a few more minutes of trying to jumpstart it, a grim-faced Dr. Glenn calls it. Kathy Lundgren hurries back to Spoke 1 to tearfully notify Eileen Braddock at Mission Control, before the body of Maine's junior senator has even had time to grow cold in the infirmary, Gwendy assumes that's where she'd be taken, Gareth Winston slips into her suite and steals away with the button box. End of story. Maybe the end of everything. Pure crap, of course. Her heart checked out fine after half a dozen treadmill stress tests. Plus, paranoid fantasies sometimes accompany Alzheimer's. That was just one of the fun facts about the illness she discovered and now wishes she hadn't, on the internet. There's even a name for it, sundowning. And since sundown up here happens roughly every 90 minutes, that leaves plenty of opportunity for weird thoughts. I am not sundowning. Maybe not, but still, no running. Best to be safe. A brisk walk will do me fine, she thinks, sitting down on the edge of the sofa cushion. Bending over, she slips on her sneakers, first the right, then the left. Then she reaches down, picks up the laces, and stops. She has no idea what to do with them. Oh, come on, she admonishes herself. Of course you know how. What was that shoe-tying rhyme she learned in preschool? Something about bunny ears, wasn't it? The bunny ears being the loops you made in the laces? She can't remember. Only that it ended beautiful and bold. Right now, Gwendy doesn't feel beautiful or bold. Just scared. She tries at least a half dozen times, but doesn't even come close. Finally, after a brief bout of crying and a thoroughly unsatisfying temper tantrum, in which she kicks off both sneakers and sends them floating across the sitting room, Gwendy pulls up a YouTube tutorial on her laptop. The girl in the video is 5 years old. Her name is Mallory, and she's from Atlanta, Georgia. The senator watches the 90-second video 3 times from start to finish, murmuring the words to the accompanying song, which she now remembers perfectly. Bunny ears, playing by a tree, crisscross the tree, trying to catch me. Bunny ears, jumped into the hole, popped out the other side, beautiful and bold. She finally manages to tie her Reeboks. Even then, they're a little loose. By the time she heads out the door, half an hour later than planned, Gwendy Peterson is daydreaming about the button box again and singing about bunny ears. Chapter 37. She's halfway around the outer corridor when Adesh Patel catches up with her. Good morning, Senator. Mind some company? Not at all, Gwendy says. But she does mind. The last thing she wants on this horrible morning is company. She's cranky and frightened and filled with doubt. What if I have another brain fart? See, that's not even right. What if I have another brain freeze and he runs back and blabbermouths to Kathy? What then? As if reading her mind, Adesh gently touches her on the shoulder and asks, Can we stop for a minute? I wanted to tell you something at dinner last night, but we were never alone long enough, and I didn't want to say it in front of the others. Gwendy stops talking and turns to face him. Is something wrong, Adesh? He lowers his eyes and shrugs. Yes, no. I mean, I don't really know, I guess. Well, spit it out and let's figure it out together. I'll try. He takes a deep, wavering breath. When Doc Glenn and Commander Lundgren first came to me asking questions about you, I had no idea what their specific concerns were or what they were thinking. I figured it was because you're, well, because I'm old. It's okay, it's true. And not a dirty word. Adesh shakes his head. No, ma'am. You might be older than the rest of us, but you're not old. Now my grandma Anya, she's old. Point taken, Gwendy says. Say on, oh revered bugman. Well, it was only later when I found out about the cognitive assessment test they made you take that I went back to them and spoke my true mind. They didn't make me do anything, Adesh. I agreed. Adesh nods, then shakes his head. Nevertheless, I was very angry when I heard what they did, and I told them so. Gwendy is genuinely touched. You're a good friend. Thank you. And when I heard that you passed the test with flying colors, I marched right back in there and said, I told you so. A brilliant woman like you could never fail such a basic assessment. If only you knew, she thinks sadly. Anyway, I needed to get that off my chest. In case people tell you, that bug man, he spoke out of turn. It's the correct phrase, isn't it? Out of turn? Yes. I just wanted you to know I had to speak my mind. She floats up a few inches to give his shoulder an affectionate squeeze, and that's when she sees it. Maybe 30 yards behind them, where the inner wall of the corridor curves out of sight, Someone is standing in the shadow of the big overhead air purifier, watching them. Before Gwendy can call out or get a better look, the figure disappears. Winston? She wonders. Say the word. She turns back to Adesh. I'm sorry, I missed that. What did you say?
I said if there's anything I can do to help you, anything at all, please just say the word.
Gwendy's mind, suddenly very clear, and what a gift that is, flashes to her laptop. Probably she forgot to put it away, just as she forgot her notebook on Eagle Heavy. But if she did put it away, and then it was not only back on the coffee table, but open. As a matter of fact, there might be something. Because of all the people she rode the rocket with, Adesh Patel is the one she trusts the most.
Tell me, he says.
Chapter 38. The Zoom meeting with the University of Maine faculty and staff goes well. Gwendy experiences one minor hiccup when speaking with the director of athletics. She accidentally refers to the Black Bears men's basketball team as the Blueberries, but she catches herself right away and makes a joke of it. Everyone enjoys a laugh, and she quickly moves on to other topics. The rest of her afternoon is spent writing a blog entry for the National Geographic Society, complete with a couple of Dave Graves' photos, and video conferencing with the vice president about climate control issues. She has always found the man well-meaning but stupid, which pretty well describes Gwendy herself these days, unfortunately. In between these chores, she catches up on emails and practices tying her shoes, murmuring the bunny song as she does. At some point, she closes her eyes and tries reaching out to Gareth Winston, but nothing comes back to her. Not even the subtlest vibrations confirming his presence on the space station. Another chocolate animal might help, but it also might be a very bad idea. At one point, Gwendy finds herself looking out the big main window with no idea how she got there. Or when. NG, she thinks. At dinner, Winston sits about as far away from Gwendy as is possible. Wonder why, she thinks with a satisfied smirk. For dessert, Sam Drinkwater surprises the crew with a pan of homemade chocolate brownies, still warm from the oven. Gwendy eats two, including a crunchy corner piece, her favorite ever since she was a young girl. They're certainly not the Button Box's special chocolates. For starters, they taste nothing alike, and for finishers, they possess not even a hint of magic. But the brownies are delicious just the same. A cozy and much-needed reminder of home and simpler times. After dinner, Gwendy stops by the weather deck. Her work is done for the day, but she's not quite tired enough to call it a night. She also doesn't want to return to her room just yet. Ever since the upsetting incident involving her running shoes, the Button Box's voice has grown louder and more insistent and more difficult to push away. She's hoping that staring into the enormous telescope for 10 or 15 minutes will be just the ticket for her beleaguered brain. But that's not the only reason she likes coming here. In some ways, the Many Flags weather deck, with its own gigantic window like a hanging glass ornament and its softly humming monitors, reminds Gwendy of Our Lady of Serene Waters Catholic Church back in Castle Rock. She finds the atmosphere calming for both the body and the soul, and it provides her a sort of celestial cathedral in which to reflect. And the view is, no pun, just truth, downright heavenly. All of this is a miracle, she thinks, staring out at the dark expanse of everything. How many other worlds exist in this endless sea of stars and planets and galaxies? How many other life forms might be staring back at me right at this very moment? She remembers a warm July night when she was 11, the summer before the Button Box first entered her life. A month earlier, just before the end of the school year, Gwendy's fifth grade science teacher, Mr. Loggins, who more often than not taught his daily lessons with a big green crusty booger visible in one or both nostrils, had taken the class on a field trip to the planetarium. Most of the kids, already snared in summer vacation's web of promise, spent those 90 minutes in the dark throwing jelly beans at their friends, gossiping about who was and who wasn't invited to Katie Sherritt's end-of-year pool party, and making fart sounds by stuffing their hands into their armpits. Not Gwendy. She had been fascinated. When she got home from school later that afternoon, she'd immediately begged her parents to buy her a telescope. After intense negotiations involving her weekend chore duties, Mr. and Mrs. Peterson agreed to share the cost with their daughter. 75% mom and dad, 25% Gwendy. On the first Saturday afternoon of summer break, Gwendy and her father drove out to the Sears store on Route 119 in Lewiston and picked up a Galaxy 313 Starfinder at 30% off the ticketed price. Gwendy was ecstatic. On the July night she's thinking about, the telescope was set up in the corner of the backyard, just a few paces away from the picnic table and grill. Her father, who had come outside earlier, was snoring in a lawn chair, a couple of empty cans of Black Label lying beside him in the freshly cut grass. After a while, her mother appeared and tucked the fuzzy red blanket from the den sofa over him. Then she joined her daughter by the telescope.
"Take a look, Mom," Gwendy said, stepping aside.
Mrs. Peterson peered into the eyepiece. What she saw, a twisting band of shimmering stars as brilliant and bright as rare diamonds, stole her breath.
"It's the constellation Scorpius," Gwendy explained, "made up of four different star clusters. It's beautiful, Gwendy. Some nights, when it's clear enough, you can see a huge red star right there in the middle. It's called Antares."
Fireflies danced in the darkness around them. Somewhere down the street, a dog began barking.
"It's like looking through a window at heaven," Mrs. Peterson said. "Do you..."
All of a sudden, Gwendy's tone was unsure.
"Do you really think there's..."
Mrs. Peterson stepped away from the telescope and looked at her daughter, who was no longer staring up at the night sky.
"Do I think what, honey? Do you really think there's a heaven?"
Mrs. Peterson was instantly struck with such an overpowering swell of love for her daughter that it made her heart ache.
"Are you thinking about Grandma Helen right now?"
Mrs. Peterson's mother had passed away earlier in the spring as a result of complications from early-onset diabetes. She was only 61. The entire family had taken it hard, especially Gwendy. It had been her first intimate experience with death. Gwendy didn't answer.
"You want to know what I believe?"
She slowly raised her eyes.
"Yes."
Mrs. Peterson glanced over at her husband. He had rolled onto his side with his back to them and was no longer snoring. The blanket had fallen into the grass. When she looked back at her daughter standing there in the dark, Mrs. Peterson was shocked at how small and fragile the 11-year-old looked.
"First of all, I want you to pay special attention to exactly what I just said. I asked if you wanted to know what I believed, right? I didn't ask if you wanted to know what I thought. There's a difference between the two. Does that make sense?"
"I think so."
"Thinking something is more often than not about logical or intellectual deduction, and that's a good thing, like the things they teach you about at school. Proper thinking leads to learning, and learning leads to knowledge. That's why you know so much about so many interesting things like the Scorpion constellation."
"Scorpius."
"Exactly," Mrs. Peterson said, ruffling Gwendy's hair.
"But believing, now that's something different, something much more personal."
"You mean like Olive Kepnes believing in the Loch Ness Monster and aliens? Those are personal choices for her?"
"That's one way to look at it. But I was thinking of God. The Bible tells us that he's real. There are hundreds of stories about him. But we've never seen him with our own eyes, right?
And no one we know, no one who's even alive right now, has ever seen him either, right?
Right.
But many of us still choose to believe that he exists. And that kind of belief, the kind that comes from deep within your heart and soul, the kind that may at times even appear to defy common logic, is faith.
We learned about faith a long time ago in Sunday school.
Well, there you go. I have faith that there's a God watching over all he's created. And I have faith that there's a wonderful place waiting for all those who choose to live a good life. I don't know what heaven looks like, or where it is, or even if it's an actual physical place. In fact, I kind of have my doubts about the whole angels wearing white robes floating around on clouds playing harps scenario. Gwendy giggled, and Mrs. Peterson felt that ache in her heart again. It wasn't a bad ache. But yes, I believe heaven exists, and Grandma Helen is there right now.
But why do you believe those things?
Look around us, Gwendy. Tell me what you see. She looked to her left, and then her right, and then up at the sky.
I see houses and trees and stars and the moon.
And what do you hear? She cocked her head to the side.
A train whistle. The Robinsons' German Shepherd barking. A car with a bad muffler.
What else? Listen closely this time. She cocked her head again, to the opposite side this time, and Mrs. Peterson lifted a hand to her face to cover a smile.
I hear the wind blowing through the treetops, and an owl hoot-hooting.
Mrs. Peterson laughed. Now tell me quick, what's your favorite memory of Grandma Helen?
Her Christmas cookies, Gwendy answered right away. And her stories. I loved her bedtime stories when I was little.
Me too, Mrs. Peterson said. Now take a look through your telescope again. She did. All of those things you just answered, and so much more. My gosh, so much more, dear girl. Think of your Grandpa Charlie and your best friend Olive. Think of those amazing star clusters of yours. And before you go to sleep tonight, take a good long look at yourself in the mirror. Those are the reasons why I believe. Do you think all those miracles could exist without a God? I don't. And do you think, before she could finish, a shooting star raced across the night sky. They stared at it with breathless wonder until it eventually flared out and disappeared. Mrs. Peterson wrapped her arms around her daughter and pulled her close. When she spoke again, it was barely a whisper, and Gwendy realized that her mother was either crying or close. And do you think God would have bothered to create all those miracles and not created a heaven to go right along with them? She shook her head. Not me.
Guess I don't either, Gwendy says now, standing in front of the weather deck's floor-to-ceiling window. And for perhaps the first time in her adult life, she truly believes it. Gwendy has an unobstructed bird's-eye view of Earth below, but she doesn't even give it a glance. Instead, she gazes far off into the mysteries of the up above, and forever onward whispers, "For me, you were the biggest miracle of all, Mom."
Chapter 39. Day 5 on Many Flags. Gwendy is almost to the cafeteria, close enough to smell freeze-dried scrambled eggs and sausage in the pleasantly filtered air of Spoke 4, when she realizes she left her red notebook back in the suite. Earlier this morning, she put it down on the coffee table next to her laptop so she could type out a quick email and told herself not to forget it. But like so many other things these days, she did forget. NG, she scolds herself, and pivots in mid-bounce like a ninja in one of the ridiculous chop-socky movies Ryan used to love so much. Despite this little speed bump, today has been a good day. Maybe even a great day. For the first time since saying goodbye to Earth's atmosphere, who am I kidding, she thinks, for the first time in probably 5 or 6 years. Gwendy Peterson enjoyed an uninterrupted night of sleep. She'd dreamt she was camping out with Olive Kepnes in her backyard in Castle Rock. They'd toasted marshmallows, flipped through a new issue of Teen Beat magazine. Sean Cassidy, oh God, such a hunk, and giggled about cute boys until the sun came up. When she'd awakened, 15 minutes before her alarm was set to go off, she felt like a brand new woman, brimming with energy and determination, and most importantly, clarity. Don't forget hope, she'd told her reflection in the steamed-up mirror after a long, relaxing shower. Two more days and all of this madness will be over. Gwendy is humming the theme song to The Sopranos and practically skipping down the main corridor in Spoke One when she runs into Dr. Glenn heading in the opposite direction. When Dale looks up and sees the senator, he flashes a grin. Someone got up on the right side of the bed this morning? Absolutely, Doc. I'm a free woman. No Zoom meetings, no conference calls, no weather girl duties. Not a single thing on the schedule today. I just might crawl back into bed after breakfast and stay there for the rest of the day. So I ask you, who's better than me? He raises his eyebrows as he glides past her on the tips of his toes. I guess that would be no one, at least not up here. See you at breakfast in a few, she says, cheerfully waving a hand over her shoulder. Just need to grab something from my room. Want me to wait? Nope, go on ahead. I'll be right behind you. Gwendy is still smiling when she opens the door to her suite. She takes a couple of steps inside and freezes. Gareth Winston is down on one knee in front of her sitting room closet. The door is open, and Gwendy's extra pressure suit has been pushed out of the way. She can see some kind of gadget, black shiny metal, not much larger than an iPhone, attached to the keypad on the safe. Several dark wires run from the base of the gadget to what looks like a small calculator with a digital readout screen. Winston is holding the calculator thingamajig in his hands. When Gwendy bursts into the room, he drops it and scrambles to his feet, leaving the gadget to float. What are you doing here? She's pretty sure she already knows the answer. Her brain may be broken, but she's not stupid. Do you have any idea how much trouble you're in? Tampering with classified material is a federal offense.
I don't believe I'm in any kind of trouble at all, Senator.
Winston's eyes look nervous, but his voice never wavers.
I guess we'll see what Commander Lundgren has to say about that. She turns to leave.
Rattlesnake quick, and twice as mean, she has just time to think. Winston lunges across the sitting room and grabs her arm. If Gwendy hadn't just seen it with her own eyes, she would have never believed the man was capable of moving that quickly. Of course, she thinks, that's zero G for you. His fingers dig into her flesh as he drags her toward the center of the room and shoves her down onto the sofa.
Even if you somehow managed to get away, it would be too late by the time you got back with the others.
What do you mean, too late?
You see that little black box over there?
He gestures to the gadget affixed to the safe's keypad. That marvel of technology is called a Lockmaster 3000. It's available to the public for not much more than the cost of a decent laptop. It usually takes no more than 10 minutes to reset a 4-digit combination and provide a new entry code. These many flags safes are a little trickier, probably because Tet is expecting some high-powered people to eventually be using the quarters up here, but in the end it'll do the job. May take 20 minutes or even half an hour, but oh yes, it'll get there.
I'd be back here a lot quicker than half an hour, and with plenty of help, too.
He scratches his chin thoughtfully.
That's assuming I let you go anywhere. It's a fair assumption on your part, I suppose. As a U.S. senator, you are used to going wherever you want, whenever you want. But this time, the assumption would be wrong. I don't want to go all snidely whiplash on you, dear, but why would I set you free to roam before I get my hands on the button box? And once I do, goodness, who knows what might happen?
When she hears the words button box come out of Gareth Winston's mouth, for a dizzying moment, Gwendy thinks she may pass out. That would be a very bad idea, she thinks. That would be the end of everything. What do you know about the button box?
Some, but not enough. I'm counting on you to fill me in on the rest.
Never, she says.
He smiles.
Spoken like a true movie heroine, but I think you will.
Let's cut to the chase, Winston, okay? We sit and wait for your little gadget to do its thing. You take possession of the box, and then what?
Then you have an unfortunate accident. If the box can't provide it, I have something that can.
She bares her teeth in a humorless grin.
They'll all know, Winston. My God, you have to see that. And you'll go to prison, federal prison, not some state dump, for the rest of your life.
I don't think so, he says, shaking his head so rapidly the flesh on his cheeks jiggles back and forth like jello. Several on board suspect you're, how shall I say this, mentally challenged.
The cognitive test.
Sam Drinkwater and Dave Graves think you cheated somehow, that nobody could score as high as you did.
I'm losing my mind, but I'm still smart enough to cheat, Gareth snickers.
I believe you just described most of your colleagues in the House and Senate, not to mention the president himself,
just smart enough to cheat. But let's not talk politics. Let's get back to you instead.
A fatal accident would be mourned, of course. You'd be a national hero, maybe get your face on a postage stamp, not to mention a million t-shirts. But no one would be that surprised. Not really. Cognitive issues so blatant you were forced to take a test? I wouldn't even be surprised if some of the bigwigs at Tet Corp lost their jobs as a result of it. The media will say your unsound mind should have shown up sooner, that somebody missed it. Dr. Glenn will undoubtedly come in for his share of the blame.
I've sent emails, Gwendy says, gesturing to her laptop on the coffee table. Friends in high places back in the States know all about you, Winnie. They know you stole the combination to the security case, for one thing. The lizard smile disappears from Winston's face. It's a possibility he hasn't considered.
Suspicion is one thing, but providing proof is quite another.
And that would be nearly impossible without any witnesses. He pulls a small object from his pocket and holds it up for her to see. It looks like a tube of lipstick, and it's the same weirdly vibrant green as the Chrysler from the Dairy video. A cartoon green. It hurts Gwendy's eyes to look at it.
A good friend of mine gave this to me. No idea what it's made of, but I can tell you this. It's virtually undetectable by modern security systems. And it's lethal. All you have to do is point, then twist the little metal loop in the base. One spray and it turns your insides into jelly. There's plenty of juice inside this canister to take care of the entire crew if necessary.
How would you get back? You gonna fly the ship home yourself? And then before she can stop herself, your little blonde friend teach you how to do that too?
Before Gwendy can react, Winston has her pinned against the back of the sofa, his meaty forearm pressing down on her throat. There's a thunderstorm in Winston's eyes, and for a terrifying moment, Gwendy is certain he's going to kill her right now.
How do you know about Bobby?
I saw it in a dream. She manages to get out. You were sitting inside a car with him, a green car.
For the first time, Winston looks unsure. And scared, that too.
Then you know enough not to fuck around with these people.
He removes his arm from her throat.
I don't think Bobby's his real name, and I don't think he's human. He and his friends mean business, and so do I.
He pauses.
He's beautiful, though, like an angel. Except sometimes it looks like there's something inside him, his real self, and that's not so beautiful.
He lowers his voice.
His real self has fur.
Sudden tears spill from Gwendy's eyes, and she silently scolds herself for showing weakness. She lifts a trembling hand to her neck and rubs the already sore muscles. It feels like something inside of her is broken.
If you were to kill me and the rest of the crew, you'd be stranded here. You'd die here, Winston.
The ugly grin resurfaces on Winston's overfed face.
Let's just say I could hitch a ride back with my Chinese friends.
They would never allow.
She stops as the reality of his words hit home.
You son of a bitch, you bribed them.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a bribe.
He chuckles into his fist.
Bribes are for pikers, dear. This was an investment in their future.
Why are you doing this? Is it money?
Keep him talking.
Don't be foolish. I have more money than I could spend in 1,000 lifetimes.
Then why?
Almost pleading now.
Why do you want it so badly?
That's quite a story.
He glances over at the closet where the Lockmaster 3000 is busy doing its thing.
But since we have time, why not?
He props his feet up on the coffee table and crosses his arms behind his head, like he's back home in his MetLife Stadium skybox, watching the Giants and the Eagles square off on a Sunday afternoon.
In October of 2024, I was in St. Louis for my father's funeral.
Chapter 40. The name of the funeral home is Broadview and Sons, and once he signs off on the bill, Gareth Winston beats feet out of there. Winston hates funeral homes, almost as much as he hated his father. It was the oldest story in the book. Nothing the devoted son accomplished was ever enough to please the overly critical father with the razor-sharp tongue, so at some point, the son simply stopped trying. Lawrence Winston III, also known as Dear Old Dad, made his piddling fortune selling commercial real estate and collecting rent checks on almost 500 two- and three-bedroom apartments in a string of downtown high-rises. In the late 80s, a reporter from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch referred to the senior Winston as a part-time slumlord and full-time scumbag. When Gareth banked his first billion at age 33, the first thing he did was FedEx his father a photocopy of that newspaper article and a handwritten note on company stationery.
I still can't hit a curveball or a two-iron. I still don't have an Ivy League diploma. I'm overweight. And I'm still not married to a beautiful Catholic virgin from across the river. But I'm filthy-ass rich and you're not. Have a miserable fucking life. Gareth.
And then he never spoke to the man again. Not even when his father called to make amends from his deathbed. The hard truth of the matter is if it weren't for his mother, whom Winston still adores and makes a point of calling every Sunday night, no matter where he is in the world, a tradition that first began after Winston left home for college, he wouldn't have even come home for the funeral, much less footed the bill. But she begged him over the telephone, and if there is one person in this world Winston can't refuse, it's his mother. Corny, but true. After the obligatory reception, there's a car waiting to take Winston back to his hotel suite, but he decides to walk instead. He needs the fresh air, plus he'd skipped breakfast this morning and is starving. Walking at a rapid pace, he cuts across McKinley Avenue, picks up South Euclid, and then takes a left onto Parkview. From there, he stops to buy 3 hot dogs and a bottle of Diet Pepsi from a street vendor, and settles his considerable bulk on an empty bench overlooking the northeastern corner of Forest Park. From where he's sitting, he can spot the pale oval of the skating rink, still 6 weeks out from opening weekend, as well as the 7th fairway of the Highlands Golf Course, which he wouldn't be caught dead playing. It's strictly for small-timers. He's wiping a dribble of mustard off his shirt when a fluorescent green Chrysler swings up to the curb beside him. It looks to be roughly 2 miles long. Winston gives the car a once-over, but is unable to determine what year it rolled off the assembly line. All he knows is that it looks very old and in cherry condition, and he's never seen another car like it.
I wonder if it's for sale, he thinks idly.
The driver's side window glides down. A man with short blonde hair and striking emerald eyes, the bottom half of his face hidden behind a red bandana, leans his head out of the car and says,
"Hop in. Let's go for a ride."
Winston grins. He's always liked a cheeky bastard, having been one himself all his life.
"Nice ride, mister, but that's not going to happen."
He starts to ask the stranger why he's wearing a mask. Few people wear masks anymore, not since the arrival of the vaccines a couple years ago, but he never gets that far.
"I don't have much time, Mr. Winston. Get in."
Winston's eyes narrow.
"How do you know my name?"
The answer to that is obvious. He's seen it in the papers or on one of the business channels where Gareth Winston is a fixture.
"Who are you?"
"A friend. And I know lots of things about you, Mr. Winston."
Because of the red bandana, Winston is unable to see the stranger's mouth, but he's nonetheless certain that the man is smiling.
"I don't know who the hell you think you're talking to, but..."
"When you were 12, you broke into your neighbor's house while they were away on vacation. Frank and Betsy Reinman. Nice people. It's a shame their son died so young."
"How do you know that?"
You stripped out of the swim trunks you were wearing and slipped on a pair of Mrs. Reinman's panties. Pale yellow with a black lace border, not too frilly. Ate an ice cream sandwich you found in their freezer, and shot some billiards in the game room. Then, before you changed back into your trunks and scooted home for dinner, you returned upstairs and masturbated on the bedspread in the Reinman's guest bedroom.
You're lying,
Winston bellows, startling a young mother walking by pushing a baby stroller. She quickly crosses the street to put some distance between them.
Stop it right now.
The billionaire's face has gone beet red and his eyes are bulging. You still have the yellow panties to this day. They're tucked away in a safety deposit box at your bank in Newark, along with a few other equally distasteful treasures.
Fake fucking news. None of what you're saying is true.
Would you like to hear some more? Winston is quiet for a moment, his broad chest rising and falling in great heaves. Then he asks in a quiet voice,
What do you want?
To make you an offer. The most generous offer you've ever been presented with. Get in the car, Mr. Winston. Let's chat.
Sounds too good to be true, and what sounds that way never is.
But he's already getting up from the park bench, leaving behind his lunch trash and walking toward the car.
Could be,
the stranger says, and removes the bandana from his face. Winston takes a good look at the stranger and does a double take, then a triple take. And suddenly there's no longer any question in his mind about getting inside the car. He isn't gay, has never found the male form even remotely attractive, especially his own. But the blonde man is so breathtakingly beautiful, Winston wants to hold the man's face in his hands and kiss him. He wants to feel those lips and taste that breath. He looks like an angel, Winston thinks, opening the passenger door and sliding into the seat.
As soon as he closes the door, a loud buzzing rises in the basement of his brain, like thousands of flies crawling over a rotting corpse. He turns to the man as the car pulls away from the curb.
Where are we going?
Just up the street and around the corner, for a little privacy. A chill dances along Winston's spine at the mention of the word privacy. He feels an instant tightening in his groin. The man cruises two blocks east and pulls into the parking lot of an abandoned warehouse. He drives around back and stops in front of an empty loading dock. Winston can see shards of broken glass, several rusty needles, and a scattering of used condoms lying on the asphalt outside of the car. But he doesn't care. Just like he doesn't care about the insistent buzzing deep in his brain. All that matters now is the blonde angel sitting next to him. The man switches off the engine and turns to him. Allow me to properly introduce myself. He extends his right hand. You can call me Bobby. Winston reaches over and takes his hand. The man's skin feels smooth and pleasant, like warm butter. The tightening in the crotch of Winston's slacks deepens to a dull throbbing. What I have to say to you, what I have to offer you, won't take long, the stranger says. But I need you to listen very carefully. Winston, adrift in a haze, slowly nods his head. My associates and I are well aware of your great wealth, Mr. Winston. But as you know, there are other standards by which to measure one's legacy. He leans across the seat, close enough for Winston to feel the man's breath wash over him. Winston's already wide eyes widen some more. Power. Control. Territory. There are other worlds than these. Many. You can rule one of them. Not just a company, not just a continent, but an entire world. And you can do it for an eternity. The buzzing sound has diminished inside of Winston's head. Now he hears something else, the sound of distant waves crashing on a rocky shore. He likes the idea of ruling a world. Who wouldn't? It's bullshit, of course, but it would be very nice. Excellent, in fact. He could see himself in a castle by the sea, listening to those crashing waves. 1,000 people bowing down as he stands above them. Hell, 10,000. As the Beach Boys' song says, wouldn't it be nice?
All we need from you is a particular item. It is in possession of a woman named Gwendolyn Peterson.
The senator?
The very same. We can try to take it ourselves. In fact, we have tried. But the tower is strong.
What tower? Winston asks in a voice that sounds nothing like his own.
The only one that matters.
The blonde man reaches over and places a hand on Winston's knee.
Winston shudders in pleasure.
He may be gay after all, at least in this man's presence.
Gwendolyn Peterson has what we need to destroy the tower. You must find it and bring it to us. Because of your enormous wealth and political connections, you are uniquely fitted for this task.
You're insane. The roar of the ocean swells inside Winston's head.
Close your eyes, Bobby commands.
Winston is helpless not to obey. It's like being hypnotized. He feels the kiss of a cool breeze upon his face and smells a tinge of salt in the air as soon as his eyes are shut. And then he can taste it on his tongue, the ocean. The sound of crashing waves grows louder, only now it's not just inside his head. It's everywhere. A bird cries out somewhere above him, a gull of some kind, and a chorus of birds answer it.
Now open them.
Gareth Winston opens his eyes, and he's no longer sitting in the green Chrysler behind an abandoned St. Louis warehouse. Instead, he's sitting beside the blonde man in a meadow of windswept grass. He stands up and looks down at a churning sea of emerald water. Hundreds of feet below, white-tipped waves crash upon an endless shoreline of jagged rock and sand. The sky above them is streaked with purple and yellow, and there are birds, hundreds of them, floating on the wind. The sun rising over the watery horizon is a deep crimson.
This is real, he thinks.
My God, this is real. What have you done to me?
Turn around, Mr. Winston.
He does, slowly, like moving in a dream, but this is no dream. The man points off to the west at a distant city that stretches as far as Winston's eyes can see. The early morning sunlight glints off the windows of scores of tall buildings. A complex spiderweb of roadways and bridges weave their way amongst the shimmering metropolis. It's too far away for Winston to determine the type of vehicles that are currently traveling those roads, but there are many of them. In the sky above the city, there's nary a hint of smog or pollution.
How big is it?
Winston asks in dazed awe.
Bigger than New York City, Chicago, and Los Angeles combined. And still growing.
Surrounded by nearly 50,000 acres of virgin woodland. Winston whistles appreciatively.
There are another 2 dozen cities just like it, scattered throughout the world I'm offering you.
Winston points a finger at a long, dark scar of barren land a few miles directly in front of them. Tiny black figures, like busy ants in a child's ant farm, scurry back and forth in staggered lines.
What's that over there?
That, the man says, a satisfied smile creeping across his face. Is your diamond mine.
Really?
Really. For the first time since he stood up from the park bench, there's a glimmer of the old Gareth Winston. His eyes look greedy and hungry. And over there, his new friend continues, pointing to a sprawling castle sitting atop a hilltop overlooking the ocean, is your home. One of many, I might add. For this residence alone, you employ, a rather kind way of wording it, considering you tender none of them a salary, more than 200 men and women from a nearby village. In exchange for their loyalty and labor, you might allow them to grow their own food tax-free.
Of course, Gareth mutters.
In spite of his amazement, his businessman's brain is ticking over.
And possibly medical care. People who think loyalty can't be bought are idiots. There'd have to be some sort of retirement benefits, at least for those close to me.
Bobby laughs. The teeth that are momentarily exposed are not those of an angel. Yellow and crooked. They are the teeth of a rat. See? You've already begun to plan. Given your extraordinary mind, you should be quite the successful ruler. And as the years, the decades, the centuries roll by, you will become not a man, but a god to those you rule over.
And there are women?
Winston asks, looking and sounding more and more like his old self with each passing minute.
Not that I've ever had much luck with that.
Luck plays no role here. Not when you're the king. Not when you're young and handsome and strong. Winston laughs.
Not so young and strong anymore, and never very handsome, I'm afraid.
I respectfully disagree, Mr. Winston. He gestures behind them. Take a look. When Winston turns and sees the tall, ornate mirror, with its glittering gold trim and polished, hand-carved oak legs positioned in the long grass, his mouth drops open. When he sees his reflection in the mirror, he gasps. He appears as young and slim as the morning he drove away to college. Here, in your world, you'll look this way forever. And as for being handsome, although you never truly believed it thanks to your father's constant disparagements, you were at one time, and remain so here, as you can see for yourself. A young man of considerable physical appeal. Your father stole from you the most important gift a young man can possess, self-confidence. The blonde man grins. This time his teeth are very straight and white. But your father is no longer with us now, is he?
No, he is not. Winston looks around. This is real?
Yes.
Could I come here again?
To visit, yes. To live and rule, not until you bring us what we want. The button box. Winston finds himself remembering a class he had in college and a particular line from that class. He didn't understand it then, but now he does.
If it's real, and if I can, I will. I promise.
The man, Bobby, turns Gareth away from the mirror. Bobby wants his undivided attention. Gwendolyn Peterson has been tasked with getting rid of this rather special box once and for all, and there is only one place in her world, or any of the others, where this can happen.
Where?
Winston asks. The blonde man stops walking. How would you feel about taking a trip to outer space, Mr. Winston? Chapter 41. Don't tell me you actually believed that cock and bull story about ruling your own private world, Gwendy says. You're one of the most successful businessmen in history. I can't believe you'd take a few moments of, I don't know, hypnosis as reality. Winston gives her an odd, knowing smile.
Do you believe it?
Gwendy actually does. She can believe in other worlds because she cannot believe the button box came from hers. Before she can open her mouth to tell a lie that might not sound very convincing, there's a beep sound.
Ah, Gareth says. I believe the safe has a new code and can now be opened. So why don't we...
Before he can finish, both of their phones give off the distinctive double tone that means an incoming text from the station, rather than a message from the down below. They both take out their phones, Gwendy from the center pocket of her coveralls, Winston from the back pocket of his chinos. Gwendy thinks, and not without sour amusement, we're like Pavlov's dogs when it comes to these things. The fate of the earth may be at stake, but when the bell rings, we salivate. Or in this case, read the text. The identical messages are from Sam Drinkwater. Joining us for breakfast?
Text him back, Winston says. Say we're in a serious conversation. No, negotiation. About the future of the space program, and they should eat without us.
Gwendy is on the verge of telling Mr. Billionaire Businessman Gareth Winston to stuff it, but doesn't. This has to end, here and now. That thought sounds like Mr. Ferris. Whether it is or isn't doesn't matter. Either way, it's true. She moves closer to Winston, so he can read the text she's preparing to send. It's exactly what he told her to say, with one addition. Important we not be disturbed until 1100 hours.
Excellent. I'm going to open this safe. I can't wait to see what Bobby was so excited about. You, my dear, should sit right where you are like a good little Gwendy.
He shows her the green lipstick tube.
Unless, that is, you want to find out what it feels like to die with your guts melting inside you.
He starts to rise, but she takes his arm and pulls him back down. In zero G, it's easy. Help me get my head around this. One hypnotic trance and you just fall into line? I don't believe it. You're not that stupid. In fact, you're not stupid at all. Winston probably knows she's just trying to buy time, but he preens at the compliment anyway. Gwendy gives him her best, wide-eyed, tell-me-more look. It usually works in Senate committees, at least with men, and it works now.
I have been back to Genesis many times, he says. That's what I call my world. Nice, eh?
Very, Gwendy says, doing the wide-eyed thing for all she's worth.
It's real enough. Bobby, he says I'd never be able to pronounce his real name, has given me certain instructions for going there. I could go there now, if I liked. My visits are necessarily short, but once I give him and his controllers this box of yours, I'll go there for good.
He gives her a goony smile that makes her doubt his sanity.
It's going to be great.
A hallucination, Gwendy persists. Had to have been. This Bobby sold you a grander version of the Brooklyn Bridge, she shakes her head. I still can't believe you fell for it. He smiles indulgently and reaches inside his shirt. He brings out a pendant on a silver chain. In the gold setting is a huge diamond.
From my mine, he says. I have others at my home in the Bahamas, some even bigger. This one is 40 carat. I had one of similar size appraised, first to make sure it was real, and second to determine its worth. The Swiss jeweler who looked at it almost had a heart attack on the spot. He offered me $190,000, which means it's probably worth twice or three times as much.
He drops the pendant back inside his shirt.
Genesis is real enough. And when I'm there, I'm young and virile. The women.
He wets his fat lips. No more panty stealing, I take it, Gwendy says. He gives her a glowering look, then actually laughs.
I suppose I deserve that. Don't know why I told you. No more panty stealing.
He looks away from Gwendy, and she thinks that while he's distracted, she might be able to grab something and whack him on the head. Except everything is fastened down, and the idea of clonking someone hard enough to knock them out in zero-G conditions is ridiculous. When he looks back at her, he's wearing a rueful smile that's almost likable. Or would be if he were not threatening her life and planning to steal the button box she's been charged with guarding and ultimately disposing of.
When Bobby took me that first time, I remembered something a teacher said in an ancient history class I took in college. I didn't want to take the damn thing, cut most of the classes, and hired some grind to do my final paper. But that one thing stuck in my head. It was from an old Greek, I think he was a Greek, named Plutarch. Or maybe he was a Roman.
Greek, Gwendy says, although he became a Roman.
Winston looks annoyed at the interruption. Whatever. This Plutarch wrote something about a conqueror named Alexander. I can't remember the exact wording, but...
Gwendy interrupts again. She likes interrupting him, and why not? He has not only interrupted her task, he's threatening to permanently interrupt her life. When Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Instead of looking pissed off, Winston smiles so widely that the bottom half of his face almost disappears, and Gwendy thinks again that he's insane. The prospect of having his own world, one where he can rule forever, has driven him over the edge. Maybe it would anybody.
That's it! Exactly! And I was like Alexander, Senator Peterson. I had no more worlds to conquer. I had reached my limit. And what did I have to look forward to? Growing older? Watching helplessly as I grew fatter, as my face began to wrinkle, as my body began to deteriorate, and my mind?
The smile becomes a nasty grin.
You'd know about that, wouldn't you?
Gwendy doesn't take the bait. For the sake of argument, let's say that world exists, Gareth. Even if it does, you won't get it. Not if you give them the button box. Winston's grin fades. What replaces it is a look of narrow distrust.
What do you mean?
What I say. Give it to them, and the world ends. If this tower is as powerful as you say it is, all worlds end, including yours, diamonds and all. He gives a scornful laugh. Why would these people, Bobby's people, do that? They'd die along with everyone and everything else.
I think. Because Bobby's people, those who pull his strings like he pulled yours, are the lords of chaos. And then, in a voice she doesn't recognize as her own, Gwendy cries, "Let the tower fall. Rule, Discordia." Winston recoils as if that voice were a hand that had struck him.
Are you insane?
It was Ferris's voice, Gwendy thinks. I don't know how or why, he must be dead by now, but it was. Then she remembers the last time she saw him on her porch in Castle Rock. I'll help if I can, he said that night.
Think about what you're doing, Winston. For God's sake, think.
I have, and I know when someone is trying to fuck with my head. Let's get a look at this fabled button box. Sit where you are, Senator. You won't get a second warning.
Of course not, Gwendy thinks. The only reason I'm still alive is because he needs to make sure he has it. Once he does, he'll point that tube at me and...
Ah, Winston says. He's peering at the safe, which puts him between Gwendy and the door.
The reset combo is 1111. I believe even someone who's losing her mind could remember that one.
He removes the lockmaster and pushes the combo. Beep, 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 beep. She hopes the gadget didn't work, that the safe will remain shut. But the door swings open when Winston pulls the handle. Out comes the steel case with classified material stamped on it.
I don't need to consult your little notebook again for the code to this one, Winston says. One look was enough. Unlike yours, my memory is in perfect working order. People are amazed at my recall. Don't sprain your shoulder patting yourself on the back, Gwendy says coldly.
Winston laughs. Now that he has the case Gwendy swore to protect with her life, he seems quite cheerful. Perhaps he's thinking of his diamond mine, or having a menage a trois with two beautiful young women. Or a ticker tape parade in one of his fine new cities with thousands of people shouting his name. Gwendy could tell him about the black button, the cancer button that supposedly ends everything, but would he listen? No. He is Alexander, with a new world to conquer.
1512253, and presto!
He opens the steel box. He looks inside. His eager smile dissolves.
What the fuck is this?
He takes out a white feather. When he lets it go, it floats in front of his face. Winston bats it away. He turns the security case so she can see inside. With the feather now out of it, the case is completely empty.
Surprise, Mr. Winston, Gwendy says.
And the slack-jawed shock on his face makes her laugh. But then shock is replaced by a look of fury Gwendy hasn't seen before. Suddenly, she can see the Gareth Winston who lives inside, and he's no laughing matter.
I'm looking at a human wolf, she thinks.
Then he grins, which is even worse. He lets go of the classified case, leaving it to float near the longtime talisman she calls her magic feather. He glides across to her. She shrinks back involuntarily and raises her hands to protect her throat.
Oh, I'm not going to choke you, he says, still smiling.
I might kill you,
he raises the green cylinder,
but it won't be a hands-on affair, and it will be very unpleasant.
Gwendy thinks, the black button is the cancer button, and that green thing is the tube of death. I've wandered into a fucking comic book. He shows her the ring on the bottom of the tube.
If I twist this all the way while it's pointed at you, the disintegration of your organs will be instantaneous. I know, because I've tried it.
On one of your subjects, Gwendy says. Her voice sounds far away. In Genesis.
You are a bright one, at least when you're in your right mind. Too bright for your own good.
The point is, my dear, that if I twist the ring slowly, a teeny, tiny bit at a time, you'll die in excruciating agony. You may actually feel your heart come loose from its moorings and drop into your stomach while it's still beating. Wouldn't that be something to experience?
Yes, it's a comic book, all right, she thinks. Too bad I can't just shut it and toss it in the UV waste disposal. Too bad it's actually happening.
You see, he says, as if speaking to a child, I've come too far to turn back now, Senator. I have burned my bridges. Which is all right, because unlike you, I have an escape hatch. One that will take me to another world. A world I've already come to love. Let me tell you what's going to happen if you don't get with the program, you smart-ass bitch. You die, miserably, screaming through your disintegrating vocal cords, and then the rest of our eagle-heavy compatriots die. Once the killing's done, I will call in my Chinese allies and we will search this place until I find what I came for. When I do, I will exit my current abode in a kind of space taxi provided by a corporation you may have heard of.
Sombra.
Yes, good for you. I'll turn over the box to those who want it so badly and exit this reality for a much more pleasant one. Do you understand?
I believe the smart-ass bitch is following you, Gwendy says.
None of that has to happen, Gwendy. You can live. The rest of the crew can live. Which will please me. You might not believe it, but I've come to like them. I will take the button box and go.
Given a choice between believing that and believing in the Tooth Fairy, I'd opt for the fairy, Gwendy thinks. But she nods as if she believes him. He's pointing the tube at her and fiddling with the ring on the bottom in a way that makes her very nervous. Only nervous is too mild a word for it. She's scared to death.
Now we come to the final Jeopardy question, Winston says.
He's still grinning, but Gwendy can see beads of perspiration on his forehead. He's scared, too. That gives her at least some comfort.
Where is it?
She opens her mouth, closes it, then opens it again. You're not going to believe this, Gareth, and I know you won't like it, but it's true. I can't remember. Chapter 42. He stares at her, eyes slitted.
You're right. I don't believe it. You aced the cognitive test they gave you. Dr. Glenn was very impressed.
I had the chocolates then.
If you don't start making sense, dear, you are going to be very sorry.
Note to self, Gwendy thinks. Having a panty thief call you dear is extremely repulsive. The button box dispenses chocolates. They're brain boosts. They do much more, some of it not good, but this is no time for lengthy explanations. I took a couple before the test. As you see, I can't do that now because the box isn't
I don't believe you. It's hogwash,
says the man who believes he's going to rule an entire planet, complete with pulp novel slave women and a handy nearby diamond mine. He slaps her. In zero G, it's not hard. Like a slap underwater, but it shocks her. She has been hit before, but not since childhood. The one who hit her lived to regret it, but not for long. Her eyes flash wide, and he sees something in them that makes him dance float backwards, leveling the tube at her. She thinks, I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, but if I get a chance, dear, I'm going to kill you. If you'd been involved in Ryan's death, I'd try to kill you twice. Luckily for you, that happened before you got involved in this business, at least if I can believe your story. And she does. According to Winston, he met Bobby 4 years later, and what reason would he have to lie? All their cards are pretty much on the table now.
You don't want to make fun of me, Senator. That's one thing you absolutely don't want to do.
I'm not. I can't remember where I put it.
In that case, I have no use for you, do I? I'll have to find it on my own, with the help of my Chinese associates. After I negate the rest of the crew, that is.
He raises the tube, and she sees in his eyes that he means to do it. Give me a minute to think, please.
I'll give you 30 seconds.
He raises his watch to his face.
Starting right now.
Gwendy knows Winston thinks she's faking. Gwendy knows she isn't. She needs to use Dr. Ambrose's trick, find a chain of association and follow it to the location of the button box. Only her time is fleeting and she can't find a starting link. Her mind is whirling.
Yes, Richard Ferris says. This isn't good. You are in dire straits.
That lights her up. And when Winston aims the tube, she raises a hand. Wait, wait, I can get it.
Dire Straits.
Not Ryan's favorite band, but one of them. And he loved that song about how sometimes you're the windshield and sometimes you're...
the bug! Sometimes you're the windshield and sometimes you're the bug! What in Christ's name are you talking about, woman?
About the bug man. The only person in the crew I trust 100%. The only one who believes in me completely.
Adesh.
I gave him the button box. I told him to put it in his lab.
Really?
Yes.
Do you know where in the lab?
Gwendy doesn't have a clue.
Yes, I'll show you. I should kill you and find it myself, he says.
He raises the green tube, then lowers it again, and smiles.
But you've been troublesome, dear. So troublesome. I think I want you to watch me take possession of your precious box. I might even let you live. Who knows?
You know, Gwendy thinks. And I know.
Let's go, while they're still all at breakfast.
He gestures with the tube.
After you, Senator.
Chapter 43. Spoke 5. They float walk down the corridor past signs in French, Lavez-vous les mains, and ramasse ta poubelle, and even ne pas fumer, which Gwendy would have thought a no-brainer. But with the French and their Gauloise, who could tell? There's that steady, low creaking. Gwendy has gotten used to it, but Winston, it seems, has not.
I hate that sound. It's like the whole place is coming apart.
No, Gwendy says. You'll be the one tearing it apart. Tearing everything apart. It doesn't even touch him. Classic narcissist, she thinks. Maybe it's true to some degree of all mega-successful businessmen and women. God, she hopes not.
Why did you give it to the brownie? And what did you tell him?
The brownie, Gwendy thinks. Jesus. And he probably thinks of Jafari as the blackie. Because I trusted him. I told you that. As for what I told him, she shook her head. Can't remember. This is a lie. Now she remembers everything. How hard it was to actually hand it over, for one thing. She remembers Adesh's look of curiosity, and most of all, she remembers telling him he must not touch the buttons. You may feel an urge to do just that, but you must resist it. Can you? Adesh had said, yes, yes. He was quite sure he could. And because Gwendy had to trust someone, she gave him the box. Then had to resist her own almost insurmountable urge to snatch it back, cradling it to her breasts and shouting, mine, mine. She even remembers thinking about Gollum again and how he called the One Ring his precious. But she had given it over.
Well, here we are, Winston says. He examines the sign on the door.
Adesh Bugman Patel. Knock before entering.
Maybe we'll skip the knocking part.
Gwendy wishes, not for the first time, that the doors of the rooms, suites, and labs on the MF station had locks. But they don't.
You first, dear. I'm not expecting a surprise, but always safe, never sorry.
She depresses the latch and steps inside. Soft sitar music is playing from a boombox, which is strapped to the center work table to keep it from floating away. Some small gadget is tucked under the strap. The second thing she sees is the last thing she expected. She told Adesh to put the button box in one of the drawers. There are at least 50 of them, but it's right out in the open, lying on the floor of the large cage where Adesh does his insect flight experiments. She can clearly see the tiny levers on the sides and the colored buttons lining the top. The door to the cage is standing open.
What's with the flies? Winston asks.
There are 6 or 7 of them hanging motionless above the button box.
Are they dead?
Resting,